Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today's show, we're going to be talking about starting a business and the tools that you can use to get funding, to get your business going. We're going to be talking to John Michael Scott and Philip Cardwell, who are experts at crowdfunding. Many people have heard all the media hype about crowdfunding and, you know, the high profile companies that have been successful at it. But the reality is that most campaigns fail. Most people don't get anywhere near the money that they're going after. But John Michael Scott and Philip Cardwell have had excellent success and a great track record on crowdfunding. But they look at it differently. And so they're going to be here to give us all tips on what it takes to be successful at crowdfunding. I think it's a must-listen-to show as far as making that work. First, we're going to be talking with Bob Hobbs Jr., who is the founder of Tallwave. They're a company that works exclusively with startup companies and early stage companies to help them get things done, as they say. We help people get things done, which if anybody has ever started a business, they know that the bottom line is you have to get it done, and you got to get it done efficiently, effectively, and things need to work. And they help entrepreneurs through that process. They call it commercialization. It happens through a process of building products and taking them to market. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about our solar project that we're doing with True North Solar. We're currently working on our financing. How do I get the best financing for this project? And I'm learning all sorts of stuff that a lot of solar companies are giving you financing at 2.99%. But what you don't realize is behind the scenes, the financier is charging the dealer. The dealer is the solar company, 10 to 13% for that referral and for that financing. And so in actuality, because they have to charge you that back. So in actuality, you're paying about, 10% for that project. And so what you really want to do is look for financing on your own, whether your state, I know the state of Minnesota has a fix-up fund. So if you make less than $96,000, $96,400, I think that's what it is, that you can qualify for this fund. I think it's 4.99% for part of it, or 5.99%, depending on what you're actually doing. And if you come to the table with your own financing, you really should be negotiating an additional 10% off, because you know that they're paying less now for that financing. If you're bringing it, they're not paying the 10 to 13% that they would if you did the 2.99% through them. So remember that if you're going to go get your financing. The other option you may have is to just do an equity line through your bank. If you have a decent amount of equity in your home, you could get an equity line pretty easily from your bank if you have good credit and so forth. So look at those options and remember that you're not getting the deal that you think you're getting with that 2.99%. Now, of course, if the overall package is less, you're bringing your own financing and you're still paying the same amount as somebody that's giving you a 2.99%, then, well, maybe that's not so bad. You can afford to pay a little bit more upfront, but just remember that financing company is making quite a bit of money on this, more than they should for a typical loan like this. But why I like True North Solar so much is they've been so honest with me on how this all works. And I really appreciate that, because nowadays the financing companies are, I mean, I gotta be honest, financing companies, I think, play a lot of games behind the scenes. And so if you can find an honest, trustworthy company that will tell you like it is, you're golden. Because more than likely those honest, trustworthy companies are going to do a better job throughout the project as well, because they just how they conduct themselves. I'm really happy with what's going on so far, and I will keep everybody posted on my project. And so now I'm going to welcome Bob Hobbs Jr. to the show. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, we're going to dive right in. Your company, Tall Wave, is interesting. I really think it fits the concept of our business changers theme and also my segment on Gear Up for 2015. Your company, I see, is on the Inc. 500 list, which is really amazing because you have to have huge growth rate for, 3 years in a row to make it to the list?
Right.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. So good job on your end. What does Tall Wave do?
So Tall Wave was created and still today provides services for early stage technology companies in the digital space. So that could be SaaS model, you know, platform companies, digital, you know, advertising, content, email, social, mobile, whatever it might be. If an entrepreneur is in that early stage of often trying to even validate if they have an idea that's worth, you know, pursuing and helping monetizing and building into a business, they would engage us to help them go through a lot of the research and validation and ultimately putting a business plan together that would allow them to go out and attract capital to get the business kind of in a position to ultimately get a real venture round of funding so they can scale and go on the market.
So what do you do with entrepreneurs to vet them, to know that these are people that you want to work with? And, yeah, I mean, how do you get to that point?
Well, I mean, initially, I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, we are a fee-for-service type company. So obviously, you know, we're working with all kinds of different people. When it comes to, you know, a relationship beyond kind of the initial client engagement, obviously we do quite a bit of homework, you know, on the business itself and the people that are around it. But initially, you know, we're working with people from all over the place. We work with entrepreneurs.
So you work with Uncle Bob down the street? You mean you don't care. As long as they have an idea, you'll work with them.
As long as they have an idea and they do have some access to capital, and not a lot of capital, but, you know, one of the things that makes Tallwave different a little bit from other, accelerator groups or often, you know, you hear the term like incubators is we're a for-profit entity and, you know, we have a P&L that we're responsible for. So, you know, we want to do a good job and hopefully by doing a good job, we grow and then we stay in business and we expand and, so we're very dedicated to making sure we're just, you know, doing a really good job for our clients.
Okay, so and you want to make sure they're in the digital space and you're honest with people. Well, I really don't know if you, because you don't want to put your resources into something that's not going to be fruitful too, right? I mean, you ideally want your. So is there times where people come to you and you're honest with them that I'm not sure you need to flush this idea out a little bit, or do you help them flush the ideas out?
You know, it's interesting you say that. Obviously, we're always honest, even if that means there's a chance that we could lose a client. But typically, our job when they've engaged with us is to help them validate their own assumptions. It's not like we're trying to put these ideas in people's minds. They're coming to us trying to solve a problem for a particular industry they're in. It could be in real estate. It could be in medicine. It could be in fashion. It could be in just about anything. And if they're trying to use the digital marketplace or you know, building an online tool or app to solve a problem, really what they're looking to us for is validation that their assumptions are, in fact, accurate. And typically when we're going down one of our programs, you're going to find some that are and are not accurate. And the most important thing is that as we're discovering these things, we make decisions on how to best pivot the business. Hopefully there's alignment when we're done with our engagement. And if there's not, I mean, sometimes that's where we part ways and, you know, the entrepreneur, you know, has the right to go off and obviously clearly build the business, you know, in another maybe way or manner. But that doesn't happen very often. I think more times than not, there isn't a right or wrong answer necessarily. It's just not what you thought it was going to be going into it. So there's a lot of pivoting going on to get it to where it's ready for the market, meaning you found that fit.
Sure.
And then hopefully you're finding those things out before you go into a design or build stage of the business. Because I will tell you, we do have clients that find us, unfortunately, after they've, you know, built and tried to take something to market and they didn't do any of the validation. They didn't do any of the product market fit work. And when we look at it, we see it clear as day that they built something that the market just doesn't demand. And then unfortunately, at that point, we'd have to kind of unwind things and help them go back to the drawing board. And it's much harder to do it at that point because it's just more difficult.
Well, because you have to, it takes a lot more effort to unwind things. And I, just in my experience, that something that you think is really great, I've noticed that maybe I'm unique here, but a lot of things I think is really great, a lot of other people just don't demand it, right? And so you have to really look at what the demand is out there and see, you know, in the business space, I suppose it's, you know, consumer space is a little different than what I like as a product. But, you know, if you're solving a business problem, there really has to be a problem there that people are willing to spend money on. And
exactly right.
Yeah. And it can't just be a gee whiz bang high tech thing. I come from a background of I have an engineering degree in computer science, so I come from that arena. And, you know, so many people look at high-tech gadgetry as cool, but that's not necessarily solving a problem, and you won't make money on that.
Right. Yeah, I think you just hit the nail on the head. You don't get into business, or you don't get into this world that we live in because you want to build an app or you want to, you know, do something. You want to solve a problem. And the problem you're solving might include building some type of online technology to do it. But to your point, unless people are willing to pay for it, it's just a great idea that a lot of people use and have fun. But there is no business. And you know, our goal is to help take these ideas and make these entrepreneurs successful. You know, at actually turning their ideas into a business versus just a great idea that, you know, people will use until you actually ask them to pay for it.
Well, exactly. So your part of your business model is entrepreneurial education. What does that entail? What is that?
You know, it's fairly basic. It's basically teaching, you know, what I would call prospective entrepreneurs, right? They're not even sure if they are one. They just know that, you know, they've got some ideas around different things they might want to explore in the way of, solving for issues within their industry, and they don't know what it means to be an entrepreneur, and they don't understand kind of how to put things in order, what you have to do first, you know, even down to the basics of, you know, unpacking your idea, you know, what is it, and what are you really trying to solve for, and assuming that you think there's a need, what are the steps you need to take in order to go down the path very efficiently. So it could be, you know, just general education, even around business formation. You know, a lot of people don't when they get into, you know, just determining they want to get into this kind of an industry, know how should I formulate my company? Should it be an LLC? Should it be a C corp? Should it be an S corp? I mean, we don't give legal advice, but clearly we've been around the block, you know, enough times to know how, you know, businesses should be, you know, put together and then we teach them the principles around really lean business design thinking, and getting them to focus their time and energy and whatever minimal capital they have on really validating that there's something there before they even worry about, you know, doing a lot of things that everyone wants to run to, which is just building something. So it's more like education around. Are you sure you really want to get in this? You know what I mean? It's a long haul.
When you get into the lean model, which is so important, and I think people forget that, but there's a company that I just interviewed that's going to go online on Monday that is part of my Gear Up for 2015 segment called Business Apps. Have you heard of them?
You know, I have. I'm not overly familiar with them, but
it might be. It might be something that it's an inexpensive platform. I just got to put in another plug for them because it. For entrepreneurs, I think it's a toolkit that you might want to look at because it's like $59 a month and it allows them to build applications on mobile devices. And now it might not be the full deal what you want to eventually do, but it would let you do proof of concept and do, from what I understand, it's a full-blown deal to do business-to-business applications. And it's really geared for small businesses to do it to consumers or small businesses to small businesses. But mm-hmm. that could be a wonderful tool for entrepreneurs trying to be really, really lean.
Yeah, so we have something similar. Ours is much more, in depth, just based on the overview you gave me. But we have a program that we provide called Sandcastle.
Oh, okay.
And, earlier this year, we partnered or actually acquired a company, called 29th Drive, which is a, UI UX firm. They happen to be here locally. They're originally out of Seattle. And they're part of our Tallwave team now. And we offer what's called basically a 2-week business validation and UX prototype sprint. So you, in less than 2 weeks, spend intense amount of time doing a lot of unpacking of the idea. We do a lot of ideating, which means we're actually beginning to draw or almost sketch around what does the app going to look like that they're going to build in order to solve this problem. Then our team ultimately will build not even a minimal viable product, just a functional prototype that we can then get in the hands of different user groups to test.
Oh, that's great.
And validate the product.
Yeah, so you have a lean design process to, let's just get it out there. It's not going to be perfect, but let's get some stuff out there to see really is this a good idea. And then we can build more perfect beyond that, but let's get it out there because we don't want to spend money or that much money until we know that this is pretty decent.
Yeah, and the other thing that this part of this does provide is you get this user validation with the prototype in our hands. So then from that, we can check a lot of the boxes, come back, regroup, and say, okay, were we accurate in our assumptions in building the tool? What do we learn? And here's what needs to be tweaked. And then obviously you need to, have different iterations before it actually goes into some sort of a functioning product.
But there's a difference between tweaking little user needs and the concept overall.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, the other thing I would add too, which is interesting, I'm always puzzled when people come to us and they say, well, I've got a product or I'm testing the product, it's in beta, and I ask them, well, who's in the beta? And it's, a very common answer is, well, it's, a bunch of people that I know and my friends, my family and my office. And in my mind, that's not a beta. That is, a bunch of friends and family and coworkers who want to see you succeed. That they're going to give you good feedback, but not necessarily unbiased. And so we provide, although not tons, we do provide user groups. So we do our testing independent of the actual entrepreneur being in the room when we're doing it.
Yeah.
So we're
you need the reality. You need the pie in the face stuff.
Exactly.
You need the hardcore.
Exactly. And that's,
you're exactly right. Stuff. Yeah. So do you provide capital for startup companies?
So it's a good question, and we get that asked to us all the time. Tallwave, is an organization that does own and operate a few companies in our managed portfolio, but from a providing capital to clients, that is not what we do. What we did, though, to allow us and investors the opportunity to take advantage of clients that kind of come past our door, if you will, we have a sister company, if you will, called Tallwave Capital, that is a commercialization fund. It's a $13 million fund, and it's designed and makes investments at the seed level into companies that fit that profile. So they're technology companies. It could be as early as concept, although we don't do a lot of that. I think we focus more on products developed, they have some users, they're wanting to move from beta into a, paid, model, and then we make investments in those types of companies. So that is a way for us, to help clients. But I will tell you this, that for anybody who's interested in Tallwave Capital, the company invests in whatever it wants. There is no stipulation that it has to be a company that Tallwave worked with in order to get an opportunity for an investment.
You just look for good opportunities, and if it's a good opportunity, you do it.
And we do, and we see opportunities from all over the country, and actually even the world. We're getting inundated with all kinds of opportunities. So
it must feed back and forth, I would think.
What's that?
The two companies feeds back and forth, I would think.
Oh, for sure, yeah, absolutely. We have clients. Or companies that actually get introduced to Tallwave Capital who, you know, may not be quite ready for an investment that we might want to make, but Tallwave can fill the gaps of some of their weaknesses or some of their areas that they need improvement in, or maybe they need to retool their product. And, you know, we obviously have a team over here that provides those types of services, and there's introductions made, and if the entrepreneur feels that Tallwave's team is suitable and one they want to work with, and of course that could turn into a client opportunity for Tallwave. But you know, and we do have, you know, people that come to Tallwave for services, and we realize that they don't need them, meaning that maybe they're far enough along, but then they find out we have Tallwave Capital, and so I make an introduction to the principal of our fund, whose name is Greg Lehman. And he is he's, if you will, the director that, you know, manages the fund. So yeah, it's a lot of nice cross, kind of cross.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, it just makes sense. So do you also help the companies get to that next stage beyond the $50 million, that fund that starts the seed investment? Do you also get to the next stage of funding with people?
You mean, do we invest in
or do you help them get to the next stage, or do you pretty much get them started and then, I mean, your services is more the startup, right?
Yeah, the service side of the business, we'll work with clients as long as they want to engage with us. The fund, though, you know, the fund's not typically going to follow a company through all the different rounds of funding. But we will do A rounds. If we do an A round, we'll more than likely co-invest. We have syndication partners that we've already begun to build relationships with.
Oh, I see.
Primarily in Los Angeles, you know,
so basically,
the Bay Area.
When they're ready, not to cut you up, but basically when they're ready to get to the next round, you have different, relationships with other companies that you can work with. And because if you're investing in these startups, you really want it to go. So you're going to help them.
Yeah, we do. And our fund, and if you go on our website, under Tallwave, you can go to Tallwave Capital, and you can see some of the advisors, and the investment committee members that are part of the fund. We have some very, very talented, technology, background people that have been very successful. And so we provide, you know, what I would say, hopefully smart money, where we're able to provide relationships.
Well, who do you have? What are some of the companies that they've helped get going?
Well, we're just now, actually, it's funny you ask that, we're just now, you mean our advisors?
Yeah, what are some of the,
okay. Well, one of the investment committee members, yeah, there's four of us, one of the investment committee members, with me, is a gentleman named Alan Kaplan. Alan, was the, founder of a company here, locally called Limelight, that went on to do, an IPO. He was involved with, Unicorn Media, which recently, sold as well. And then the other gentleman who's on the investment committee with me and my other business partner is a guy named David Holfe. Dave was a former CEO of Circle K, and then a managing member of a group called Inline Capital.
Yeah.
And so the four of us make the investment decisions, but we have an advisory group of about an additional 8 to 10, you know, groups or people here with deep backgrounds into, you know, and it's all on our website, by the way.
Okay, well, good. Well, you sounds like you guys have a really good program for companies that are starting up and they really need support like this. Can I put your information on my website and the radio show,
sure,
in case people, and in closing, what is your startup competition? What's that all about?
So our startup competition is called High Tide, and it's actually something we've done 3 times, like all things. I think it changes every time. But essentially it was put in place to allow companies that don't necessarily have the resources, to work with, you know, a company like Tallwave or a service firm, to be able to, almost compete, for the ability to go through similar program, or, you know, for the types of services that Tallwave provides to just paying clients. So it really opened the funnel up. Allowed companies from all over the country in each High Tide. And again, we've had three, you know, we've had probably around 200 and some applicants, and you name it, from everything from EdTech IT to healthcare IT to ad tech to, just you name it. And so then they get whittled down to, you know, the select few to get the opportunity to go through the program. And there's a small exchange of equity with the fund. Because the fund is who's been sponsoring these programs. But high tide is something that you probably won't see us do again here in the near future. If we do another one, it'll probably won't be for, you know, some period of time. But it is a good program. And if there's people out there that are interested in it, they should definitely contact us. You know, because it is something that's going to come up again. I just don't have one, you know, scheduled, you know, from a time perspective yet.
Well, I know this is a continually booming industry with the mobile app, mobile devices, and it's just continually changing. There's going to be a never end of business ideas and opportunities for you. So I appreciate so much for you coming on the show, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you having me, and you too. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
All right.
So if you have a startup company that's in high tech and you fit the mold of Tallwave, or if you have a startup company that needs help in general, maybe you talk to a different company that does more like what Tallwave does, it can really help you save money in the long run, because you want to go through the effort of making sure the product that you have is going to sell, that you have a market for it, and that you have a prototype that's been developed enough that you can figure out if you have a market for it and you can make money on it before you raise any kind of significant capital. And whether you're going to go for angel investors, a venture fund, whether you're going to tap into your own money, or whether you're going to do crowdfunding for your new venture, regardless of what you do, you want to make sure you get it to a certain point, because you don't want to spend money or any kind of significant money until you have proven it to a certain point. And of course, you're going to need a little bit of funding up front to do that, but that's more of seed capital. And seed capital is harder. Seed capital you're going to need to get from family, friends, yourself, more personal sources. And that's kind of the trick with being an entrepreneur. How do I build a company with, without having much funds? But there's other sources. Like we were saying, if you have a high tech company, you can do a prototype pretty inexpensively. And I had a company called Business Apps on earlier that has a platform that's not very expensive per month. So for less than $100, you can get a prototype out there. And working with Tallwave, you might have to put over a small chunk of change. But if you're going to go out and raise a couple million dollars, you're going to be saving a lot of money up front. If you find out that that product needs to change a little bit to really get to the target market, if you change it a little bit and end up making three times more, then you way pay for it. So it's just something to look at. But now that we're on this topic of getting money, it's perfect lead-in to bringing on our crowdfunding experts. Hi, Philip and John Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm doing great today. I am so glad that you're here. There's so many people that have been wondering about crowdfunding, and I think there's a lot of confusion out there, and there's also a lot of excitement about this new way to raise money for companies. And so I just want to dive. Go ahead.
No, there really is, and I wanted to start off by saying thank you for having us on, Sarah. And by the way, congratulations on Business Game Changers. I've read that it's one of the fastest-growing shows on Web Talk Radio, so congrats.
Thank you. Thanks much. Yeah, I'm having a great time with it. So, okay, so let's just start with some basic things. Like, what is crowdfunding?
Well, Sarah, right now there's two kinds of crowdfunding. There's traditional crowdfunding, which people frequently refer to as the donation version, and there's equity crowdfunding. Now, that's still in its infancy, and it's brought into play really in 2012 when President Obama signed the Jobs Act, which actually stands for those who are interested, Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. These are two types of crowdfunding that are very, very different, and I think it's important that people understand that difference. In traditional crowdfunding, the donation model, it's been around for a while.
Let's clear that the donation model is legal right now, right? And the equity model isn't quite legal everywhere yet. Is that correct?
Actually, they're actually both legal, and they're both being practiced in all 50 states. There are some differences. I'll go back to the traditional donation model for a bit. Okay, that focuses primarily on creative ventures and causes. In other words, most people will know the version of crowdfunding when they hear the word Kickstarter or Indiegogo. And it's where entrepreneurs will put an idea out there on the web and solicit funding. You know, the donors usually get a perk like a t-shirt or some kind of pre-ordered or pre-released CD and some other product in exchange for helping a good cause or some cool new venture.
How much? That's all they get. Well, how much do people usually donate in those kind of situations on average?
Your average donation is around, and I'm rounding here, it's around $20. And later, if you want to, we can get into some actual, some percentages as far as some of the rough math that we use in determining whether or not a person's likely to be successful.
So yeah, I would like to talk about that. But you pretty much, if you want to do anything of size, you need to get a lot of people.
Well, you absolutely have to get a lot of people, and that's what it's all about. I mean, and, you know, back to when you ask about the types of crowdfunding like that, you know, in these traditional crowdfunding donation models, you know, after the campaign's ended and that perk's been delivered, there's no ongoing relationship between the entrepreneur and the donor. The crowdfunding campaign, or the whole process, if you will, is over. And if you wanted to contrast that, you ask about the other type of crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding. You know, it uses a similar approach in asking the crowd to fund a business or a product, but with an equity crowdfunding, the entrepreneur selling shares or an ownership stake in his business. The financial backers aren't getting t-shirts or products. They're investors hoping for a return. And that means that, like other companies that issue stock, that, you know, they have to register these startups with state regulators under securities laws or apply for exemptions.
So it allows an average person to get involved in a fun project that they really believe in.
Absolutely.
And not just get a t-shirt, but they actually can be part owner of this company. So
correct.
So who are the typical people that crowdfund? What are you seeing out there?
It kind of varies. The typical scenario for donation scenarios and reward scenarios, like when you get a good for your contribution, those are more often than not going to be companies that are, or even individuals that are creating some kind of a product. It's very seldom found to be successful for a service provider or some kind of a business-to-business company to be successful on the donation and reward side. Once you get into the equity side, I mean, it's really more about what people are interested in. So if you are an angel investor or just a high net worth individual, I mean, you're going to have things that you consider your sweet spots.
Well,
and
equity,
are the things that you're going to want to
I would think equity fundraising is really opens up a whole nother rich group of people that are willing to invest. Whereas the typical donation crowdfunding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is more for it's really a consumer-based deal, right? I mean, it's more, I mean, if you're going to get a t-shirt or somebody who really believes in a product, but they're not doing it for anything more than just out of donation or out of goodwill.
Well, no, I'd really stop that line of thinking pretty quick. The people who come on to Kickstarter or sites where they're, you know, getting some kind of a good, they're not donating to the purpose of goodwill. I mean, if you are putting money into a film or into the next cooler or into getting early access to a wearable fitness device, you're not doing it just because you feel good about it.
Okay,
you're doing it because you want that device.
So people are getting other incentives. They might be able to be the first consumer to get a product, or they might. So let's get on to what makes a person from the general public willing to invest in, you know, to get behind a project, not the equity based one, but the donation based one.
You know, when they're getting behind a project, it's usually because they have some kind of a connection to the person who has put the project out there. I mean, that's how it begins. That's how the snowball starts. So usually the general public, if you think about it as far as like the average random internet consumer, they don't even necessarily know that the project exists. And part of the reason for this is because there are really so many projects. So, you know, if you were to go on to any one of these sites, you would find On the most popular sites, you'd find, you know, 1,000 projects or more that are currently active at this moment. And there's no way that, you know, any one person is going to sit there and stare at one of these sites all day night, all day long and all night long, looking through every single project that's there. So what gets people there in the first place is some kind of a connection. You know, I'm a filmmaker, and so I am going to tell all my friends, and they're going to tell all their friends, and they're going to tell all their friends. Or I'm producing a video game, and I'm going to reach out to my past fans and people who have an interest in me and my work. That's how it starts. And then, you know, after that, there's, of course, legitimate marketing and advertising and PR, and Phil can, of course, attest to what impact that will have.
It's a great way. It's another way to market yourself and get money.
Yeah.
And you see it as a great marketing.
Hopefully.
You see it as a marketing tool, and hopefully you'll get money behind it. I just saw it.
I would take it even a step further. So
yeah.
It's a great way for people who have no experience running a business, especially, you know, individual creators who have this great inventive idea. It's a great way for them to go through basically the life of a business in 90 days. Because they have to come up with their idea, they have to be able to communicate their idea, they have to figure out what the price should be for their idea, figure out where they're going to source it from, and do all of that, and then run a campaign around marketing it and trying to get the public to buy into it in a, you know, at a scalable level. That's something very
different.
That's
an experience. I still say it's not as hardcore as actually running a business, but it's hard, I'm sure.
It's skimming across the surface, but it is a 24-hour-a-day job while you're doing it. So,
well, I just saw a newspaper, the New York Times put on an article on just this past week about public radio is now going all towards podcasting. And so they did a big crowdfunding campaign to raise the money to do this. And I found it as interesting. It's the largest crowdfunding campaign around that. Go ahead.
It's a really interesting thing when you see something like that come up. And a lot of what you see in those scenarios is a brand, if you will, National Public Radio or one of the individual stations. You're seeing that brand just like they do in their yearly, you know, donation campaigns. You're seeing that brand activate the audience of people who are already fans that they can reach out to.
And they're used to donating already, right?
All of this works. To a great degree, yes. If you can activate an audience who's already backing something, you're going to see a lot better results.
So,
Zach Braff activating his audience, who he's very engaged with, to get behind his movie campaign, yeah, that's going to lead you to great results. On the other hand, you know, James Franco trying to activate his crowd, who he has no engagement with, did not lead to great results.
Was that a movie that he was trying to get going or something?
Yeah, both of them came to crowdfunding and attempted to get movies funded. And Zach Braff succeeded famously. He's an outlier. He has a really highly engaged audience of millions of people. James Franco has, you know, a lot of fans, but they don't have particularly a relationship with him. And so when he came to the table with his film, he got very little support. And to put this into perspective, I'm talking like a difference of sixfold.
Wow.
You know, James Franco's campaign versus Zach Braff's campaign, and arguably James Franco has more visibility, more prospects in the industry. He's much more significant than Zach Braff.
Well, what is his name, Zach?
Zach Braff?
Yeah, what did he do?
He went to the well for a sequel to a movie called Garden State. He did crowdfunding the hard way before these portals existed and got people to rally behind Garden State in the first place. He's maybe most famous for his work as a principal actor on Scrubs.
Oh, okay.
So he showed up, and because he's got this great indie fan base, he was able to activate that crowd and to get them to rally behind his project. It's an important point, right? So people who have no audience and have spent no time engaging with and forming a relationship with their audience, I don't care whether they are, you know, trying to get equity fundraising or whether they're trying to get, people to support their donation or their reward-based crowdfunding. If you have no audience and if you've spent no time on networking and engaging to to social media and in-person relationships, you're going to have an extremely difficult time succeeding.
Well, how do you get people to get that? I mean, you can't just go in. Most people don't have that, right? And so how, like, what could James Franco have done to make it work better for him? What would you have done? Because not everyone is sitting there with the right base of people, right? I mean, very few.
Well, in reality, though, Sarah, if you think about it, there are very few people that actually have that base. If you look at the entire universe of crowdfunders versus those who actually have a base that you're referring to, you'll find that it's infinitesimally small, which means that for the vast majority of crowdfunders, they're going to have to get out there and build that base. Now, to put this into perspective, I'm going to let John Michael explain a project that he's been working on. And this is good for someone who's considering doing a crowdfunding campaign, because it will tell you, when you said a minute ago, you're not so sure if it's as hard as running a business. It actually can be, because listen to what he has gone through in order to develop that audience participation on his project.
Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, I mean, to put this in a perspective, when so I have my own campaign, as Philip mentioned, and it's really about trying to found a company that creates products that help people to learn through experiential learning, through games. And
so it's kind of like virtual reality. Is it, not to interrupt here, but is it more along the lines of starting to go towards virtual reality?
No. It's real reality, actually. So, I mean, you're having these experiences that are allusions to reality. You're playing through a metaphor. You're playing through a board game in order to gain these experiences, and you're playing with people and against people in the process.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Representing the thing you're trying to learn, right? So we started working on our audience for this over a year ago, and we're not ready to crowdfund. We know what the audience is, the size of the audience is that we need. We've done the statistics and done our homework, and we know that we are going to have to get into campaign mode, just like a political campaign. We're going to have to get into campaign mode, and we're going to have to really work hard to secure the base of support that we need in order to launch. We're not going to launch for about 6 months for more or less those reasons. There's a few things to deal with in logistics and manufacturing for what we're creating. But at the end of the day, we started over a year ago, and that's
so that's you don't see crowdfunding as the seed money. Crowdfunding is for the next phase, right? I mean, you have to get seed money in this particular project. You must have seed money from somewhere else, whether it's your own personal finances or somebody who's investing in it. And then to get to the next stage where you're going to, you know, take it more big time, then you use the crowdfunding. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, let me bring up an interesting, we mentioned we would get into this, into some statistics. I'll bring up some interesting facts as they exist right now. The average donation runs at around $20 to $25. I'm going to round on this. And the average participation due to Nielsen is 0%. So what you're looking at is they have a term called pre-funding. And right now that level is running at around 30% for projects. And what that means is that the major platforms like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, they went and took a look at the projects that were successful, and they tried to determine what is it that they have in common. And the glaring thing that showed was that the majority of them that were successful were pre-funded 30% of what they were seeking to raise within the first 2 or 3 days of the campaign going live. So while crowdfunding you could use in the past as a way to raise all of the money, now it is used to supplement or to finish off the money that you need to raise. And part of that is due to oversaturation. You now have an abundance of crowdfunding projects out there, and you have a smaller amount of dollars per ratio chasing those crowdfunding projects.
Well, yeah, because nobody's getting just equity, right? And I got to go back to it.
None of this is.
If it's equity based, then it's I would think it would be easier, but maybe nothing's easy in business.
I mean, I think you're right. Nothing is easy in business, but I think what is.
People
what
will
is
sell it that way.
That, I know, right? What I think is true here is that you actually have two assets that you could call your seed capital, right? You as a person, every person has two assets, and they may have more of one or more of the other. But the two assets are basically time and dollars. So if what you've got is time, then audience development means, you know, going on to social media, going to meetups, going to in-person events and online events, and forming, you know, connections with people. So you're expending your asset of time. If, on the other hand, you happen to be, you know, the beneficiary of a wonderful pile of liquidity in the form of cash, great. Then you can pay for your engagement, audience development. You pay others to do that through, you know, pay-per-click advertising or sponsorships or who knows what. But the what is still true, no matter what, is that, you know, you have these statistics that Philip mentioned, and if you, you know, you can try to get around the statistics, but if you're really trying to run a campaign with a goal of guaranteed success as opposed to just hoping for, you know, magic to happen or to be an outlier and to catch a wave, unless you're hoping for that, you're going to realize that your best chance of success is by running your campaign by the numbers. So I'm, you know, I'm a big proponent of looking at
crowdfunding. What does that mean? How do you run a campaign by the numbers?
Sure. So I'm a big proponent of crowdfunding as being very much like political campaigning. So I want to know what, you know, what figures matter. So Phil mentioned one figure. One figure that is statistically proven by all the platforms is that it takes 30% of your total goal to occur or to come into your campaign in week one. If you don't make the 30%, your likelihood of succeeding at that point drops to somewhere less than 5%.
Well, do more people donate to successful campaigns? Is that the point?
That's part of it. That is definitely, I mean, the snowball effect is definitely part of it. People, you know, people don't want to waste their time and lock up their dollars in some cases with something that they have no realistic belief is going to succeed. That is definitely partly true.
There's another aspect to that also, and that is that as a campaign starts to mature and age and someone looks at it and sees that it's not going anywhere, then they come up with the idea that, you know, why do I want to invest in this, particularly if it's on a platform like Indiegogo where the person can keep a majority or whatever they raise. Then you have to look at it and wonder, why do I want to invest in something that looks like it's not going to fully fund anyway?
Exactly.
So as a result, as you were saying, yes, it does have a tendency to be a snowball effect.
Yeah. And, you know, so when you start with that in mind, then there's a couple things that come out of that. You have to really prepare your bank before you go live. And this is where I really think political campaigning is an applicable metaphor. If you were going to run for political office, you would not show up at the poll booths on the election day and say, "Hey, I'm here. Vote for me."
Well, you want to make it look. Yeah, you want to make it look successful. I mean, if it matters to that point, you have to make it look successful. Do you ever seed it?
Absolutely.
Or does that feel dishonest?
What's that?
Do you ever seed it, or is that kind of dishonest?
Some
people
do. Some people absolutely do. They seed their campaign. Some people will line up. I mean, there are plenty of examples of people who have lined up. Let's say their campaign is for $100,000. They will have lined up over $30,000 of money from people who they have gotten firm commitments from.
Oh, so they just pre-sell it. You pre-sell it. So it's, you're not putting your own money. You pre-sell it. You get it so that all this rush comes at the beginning and it, but they've sold it. So it's a legitimate deal.
Yeah. And again, that's exactly like a political campaign. You cannot run for national office without a treasure chest. It's impossible. And, you know, since you're dealing with the same kinds of conditions, you're dealing with the general public who don't know you personally, you're in the same position. You have to develop your war chest and, you know, get ready for the job and make sure those things are locked down before you get started.
So you guys,
and then,
you know,
we talk about the others.
Go right? ahead. Oh, I was going to say, you work with a lot of people that, I mean, people come to you on a constant basis wanting you to help them do these campaigns. So what do people come thinking? What are their biggest misconceptions with this?
Well, you know what? Let me. Yeah, I know he laughs at
that. Are most people clueless?
Well, listen, they really are, and it's not their own fault. It's like I said, they pick up on what the press puts out, and they see these outliers. John Michael's going to have his own opinion on this, but I'll tell you that to me, you know, the worst misconception that people have is relying on that old cliche that if you make it, they will come. And nothing could be further from the truth. People assume that they have this great idea for a product and all they have to do is put it on Kickstarter, sit back and watch the money flow in.
You have to sell.
The reality is that crowdfunding on the actual, well, this is another point too that we like to make to people. The crowdfunding, the actual platform that you choose, be it Kickstarter, Indiegogo, some other platform, it really doesn't significantly contribute to their funding. The only thing that drives in funding, and this is what we've kind of been hammering in for the last few minutes, is that the campaigner's relentless hard work and the marketing and advertising efforts that are being used to make the public aware that the campaign actually exists. And we know this for a fact. We've seen it time and time again. A campaigner will call us saying they've been told they need to put their campaign on Kickstarter because Kickstarter has a bigger following than Indiegogo. And through our company, Crowdfunding Accelerator, you know, our work with so many crowdfunders on multiple platforms, we've shown this not to be true. We've had clients chosen as Kickstarter's project of the day. We've had clients who've sat on the front page of Indiegogo for an entire weekend.
And
all said
not-
and done, neither situation made a significant difference in bringing funding, and that's because you have to drive people to your project.
So do you use,
not
do you use,
people.
Do you use both platforms? What platforms do you use?
You know what? We do use both platforms, but I'll tell you, to be quite honest, we prefer, in that case, Indiegogo for many reasons, and I don't want to come down on anyone.
Yeah, this isn't about it, them, but you it has more features that you like or something?
Well, there are. There are certain things, one of which is when we're spending marketing and advertising dollars, we like to be able to track. And as John Michael said, he's a numbers person. Well, I'm primarily the marketing and advertising side of that. So when we're spending marketing and advertising dollars, we want to know if it's effective or not. One of the things we like about Indiegogo is the fact that they let us install Google Analytics on all of the pages of the project, which means that I can go in and follow and track where people are coming from, how long they're spending on the video, where they're going, whether they're donating, things like that. The other thing that we like about Indiegogo is that we have great working relationships with Indiegogo. We can call the guys over there and they will either call us back or shoot us an email if there's a problem within a matter of hours.
Now, so you're not just another little fish in the sea. They actually take care of you?
Well, with us, they do.
I always call that
so many projects.
I always call that being when they get big like that, or, you know, there's so many, you feel like you're going through a McDonald's drive-through. And if I feel like I'm going through a McDonald's drive-through, I do not want to do business with them. But keep going.
Well, that's exactly why Indiegogo is starting to catch up with Kickstarter. I mean, Kickstarter, you know, as many projects as we run, we can't get the time of day from them. And to make another point here, we've actually had projects on Kickstarter that John Michael has had to submit up to 8 to 10 times because they did not like the way that the project was laid out until he finally got it right. And to me, that is just overmanaging, and it's micromanaging, and it's not the way it's supposed to be in something that's freely done as crowdfunding.
The other thing that's true.
The other thing that's true is that, you know, we've also done projects on portals that people have never even heard of. And, you know, some of our most successful projects have been, you know, conducted, like one was conducted on a portal called CrowdBrood. No one generally has any idea who CrowdBrood is. It's a crowdfunding portal for the beer industry, for the craft brew industry in particular. And,
but
you know,
that's a nice little niche market.
We also advise people too, with not just crowdfunders, but people will call us and ask us about starting new companies for crowdfunding and about portals and what software to use. And one of the things that we decided in the very beginning, and so far we've been very accurate, while there are a number of crowdfunding portals opening on a daily basis because you can buy a plugin for WordPress software and you can become a crowdfunding portal overnight, the ones that are successful are the ones who are claiming their niche and the ones who, like, for instance, you mentioned CrowdBrood, who would subsequently bought out. But the ones who are concentrating on specific crowdfunding subjects, be it wine, be it beer, be it cigars, whatever. They're not open to everyone to crowdfund everything. They're concentrating in certain areas.
Everything's about micro niche now on the internet. Well, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of when the websites first became popular in the early 90s, and people just put their website up there. It's like, well, you can't just put a website up. How many people visited this week? You know, they got like two visitors, and it was their mom and somebody else. It's that same concept.
Exactly.
And the other thing that's true when you look at the Kickstarter and Indiegogo battle is you can see vestiges of the Amazon battle, right? Where Amazon was trying to be the, you know, place where we all go to shop, and that's great. And, you know, in the world of e-commerce, Amazon is, you know, full on, the full blown leader at this point. But what is also true is that people are finding their niche shopping experiences now, and e-commerce is not getting smaller just because Amazon has claimed huge amounts of it. They have a significant chunk. It's like 20% or something.
They're just helping it get bigger is all it's doing.
Yeah, it's just exploding into multiple individualized experience-based micro niches that give people what they want.
So am I pronouncing it wrong? Is it niche or niche? I like to say niche,
I think you can say it both ways, depending on what part of the country you're from.
Yours sounds so much cooler, you know? Like being from France or something. Okay. now you see the same thing
happening in the portals as well. You know, there's this whole verticalization taking place, and even after major verticalization, you're going to see micro focus occur over time. Like there's a great portal in the film industry called Seed and Spark, and what they've done is they've differentiated themselves on the basis of unique value that they create for filmmakers.
And you can see the results. Well, anything that's mass marketed, people want to feel like they're special or that it's part of their, they want to be together with people of their like kind, and it creates a different atmosphere. So you guys tend to get hit up a lot by people wanting to get help for crowdfunding. So how do you weed out? What do you look for? How do you weed people out? Go ahead.
You know what? That's a very good question, because as it stands now, this is something we battle with on a daily basis. We probably, or at least I field probably 6 to 8 calls a day. And at a minimum, those calls run anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour. I mean, you know, as you can imagine, you've got a creative type who's calling you. He wants to tell you his whole story about his project. That gets into his life story about how his project came about. And the reality of the issue is, and I don't mean this in a bad way, about 95% of those people who call are either people that we're not going to be able to help for various reasons, be it our time, or there's a lot to be said for that audience development. You know, we keep hammering on that because it's so important. When a person calls you and says, hey, you know what? I don't know anybody. Not only do I not know anybody, I don't really have the time to build the audience, as John Michael brought up, and I certainly don't have the funds to accelerate building my audience. It's unfortunate, but crowdfunding is not for you if you're in that situation. So we constantly battle trying to figure out, you know, how do we reduce the amount of effort and time that we spend in determining whether or not we're going to deal with a particular party on this crowdfunding project?
Well, it comes back to the same point, right? It's really hard to weed out the good ideas from the non-good ideas, because a good business, they always say, and it's true with everything I've been involved in, A mediocre project with really good management is going to be more successful than a great project with bad management.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. If you have something.
No, it does. It falls back once again to, it's not always the project as much as it is that connection to the audience. There's an emotional connection a lot of times that has to be made, and there has to be so much. And I guess, you know, that's one of the things that I have a problem with too, is that people just don't seem to grasp, and it's not their fault. It's mainly due to the media. They don't grasp the amount of work and effort that goes into a project before it ever goes live. John Michael told you he's been working on his for over a year. Now that's a little long, but that has to do with the subject matter of his project. But they just don't grasp what's involved. We have people burn out sometimes a week and a half, 2 weeks into the project. And these are people who you would have thought would have you know, giving a pint of blood a day to keep the project going. But a week and a half later, 2 weeks, they've had it and they simply just, they burn out. They're done. It's not for them.
Well, how do you weed through that? That's a difficult thing. I would think that would be very hard.
It is. And unfortunately, sometimes you don't really understand or you don't know whether you're going to get into that until it occurs, which is why we have actually changed our business model several times to keep that down to the point where it doesn't cost us so much money when it occurs.
Yeah. Well, so you just have maybe some really specific questions that you ask people and try to weed it out right away. It's like doing an interview, but you don't want to have an hour interview. So you guys have
John and Michael's.
You have a problem. You have a problem on your hands.
We do. And you know, it's funny. Some people might tell you that that's a good problem to have, but it's really not. You know, John Michael's gotten very, very good in the beginning at trying to identify what type of audience that a person has or what kind of pre-funding that they're going to be able to draw in. So he's been very helpful in cutting that down.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, okay. So let's move on a little bit on.
Yeah, I mean, basically we have to, you know, go through a series of about 5 questions that immediately give you some sense as to where this person's starting from. And I'm not here to tell anyone that they shouldn't be an entrepreneur or that they shouldn't pursue their creative idea. I'm the biggest supporter in the world of people realizing their creative vision. But what I do end up doing is coaching them a lot as quickly as I possibly can so that they start moving down a path where they can have a chance of success.
Well, you have to figure out...
So, two to five questions later, and, you know, we're already positioning them in a particular direction.
Well, you have to figure out how much persistence they have, right? I mean, it's like that with any entrepreneur. Most entrepreneurs fail because they don't have the they might not have the skills, they might not have all these other things, but you have to, bottom line, you have to be persistent. I mean, you just have
to
go.
Yeah, but you know what?
Well, no, before you say that, I'll give you two questions that will answer most of what you just referred to. Question number one is, what audience have you collected? Meaning, what people can you send an email to today, right now, at this moment, that you could ask them to support your project? So that's question number one. And then question number two is, how soon do you need this project to occur? If they tell me that they need this project, they have to have the money, or they have to have this project occur in the next 2 months, and then they also tell me in question one, well, you know, I got about 500 people I can reach out to. And then the third question, I guess, right after that would be, well, what's your goal size? If they're sitting there telling me that they need to raise $50,000 or more dollars, and they have 500 people, and they have, you know, to get it done in 2 months, well, obviously, they're already set up to fail.
Okay, so what are they, what should they, what's the criteria that you're looking for?
Well, looking for somebody who's going to listen and say, okay, well, I got 500 people. When I tell them, well, you're trying to raise $50,000, and that means you're going to have to get 250,000 people. What I want to hear first is that they're committed to doing that. If they say, oh my gosh, that's, you know, that's why I'm hiring you, my answer is going to be like, okay, well, I clearly don't think that you have thought this through, because if you're going to hire me just to develop your 250,000 person audience, it's going to cost you cash up front.
Well, let me say this.
Exactly.
I'm laughing because it's
funny that people could come to you thinking that that's realistic. But I suppose anybody, they don't know. But keep going.
Well, you know what? When he says that 250,000 people are going to have to see your campaign, he's not pulling that number out of the air.
It's a lot.
And he's very good. He's good at figuring that out. And he can tell you with pretty much certainty exactly how many people, give or take, your campaign's going to have to get in front of in order for it to be successful.
So how many campaigns have you been successful with? I saw some of your stats that you, for the campaigns that you really focus on, you've had incredible success rates.
We have. We've had a great success rate. The ones, too, that we have had that have not been successful could be viewed in one of two ways. I'll give you an example. We worked in one of the campaigns early on called Newlywed and Broke, in which there were two great actors from here in L.A. who approached HBO, and HBO had told them that right now we're not really interested in starting a new series with unknowns, but we have an idea. If you can go out to YouTube and you can shoot 10 webisodes and we can figure out whether or not those webisodes are popular, then come back and talk to us and we'll see about turning it into an HBO series. Now, that campaign was attempting to raise, I can't remember if it was $25,000, $20,000, something like that. Now, did it on Indiegogo, which meant that they got to keep the proceeds that they raised, and I think they may have raised somewhere around $17,000, $18,000. John Michael may be a better gauge of that. But what happened was, while technically you could say the campaign was not a success, in reality it was a success, and it was a success for two reasons, one of which we never counted on. The first reason was it did raise enough money for them to go out, hire some good directors and everything, and start the webisodes and go ahead and start production and filming. And something we never in a million years thought about was, through our marketing and advertising efforts, the people that were involved in the campaign, meaning primarily the actors and directors, got so much exposure that their careers took off and jumped tenfold due to the exposure that they got
fantastic.
From the campaign.
Yeah, there's always...
Well, that's something else we don't talk about too a lot, and a lot of people don't understand this. There's really several reasons for running a campaign, one of which is you actually need money to get started and to have your project ever, your product, I should say, ever come to market. The second is the people who realize, you know what, I can do this project without the money, but I'm going to do this campaign because I want to raise awareness for my product.
And if they enter into it with that mindset, then you're always successful, right?
In a way, you are.
You can
spin in marketing and advertising.
You can spin your failures into successes. I'm always successful.
Well, you really can.
I shouldn't say, yeah. I've given you crap a little bit, but it's true. You really can.
In various ways, you end up with outcomes that you never saw coming, and most of the time, those are very, very good outcomes.
So,
well, let's look at just extending that just a little bit, right? One thing that is true about every project that runs on a crowdfunding site is that it becomes more or less a matter of public record. It becomes searchable, it's out there on the internet. It becomes a demonstration of the brand that that creative is crafting. It becomes a demonstration of their commitment, of their legitimacy, of how transparent they are, and how they communicate. And all of those things, if conducted well, then you can come back a month later, run a campaign again, and get that much more tailwind out of what you did previously. So I'm also a big advocate of people stair-stepping. You know, I think that if you stair-step and say, you know, go after something attainable and not, you know, not too aggressive, then you can make a proof point out of that, and you can then extend and enhance that audience as you continue.
Well, you build, and it's just like building a career,
it's
right?
Very...
It's stair-stepping. And so when you want a lot of people who are running for political office, their first time running for political office is not always a success, but it allows you to be a success next time. And it's very common.
Yeah, you build a track
very
record.
Similar, It's very similar to what happens in entrepreneurship in general, right? I mean, you don't get a $40 million investment when you're an unknown, unknown, unknown. Instead, you go and find your seed money and you get, you know, maybe an early angel round, and you prove out that you can actually execute and you have vision. And even if your startup business model turns out to be not practical, you've done such a large amount to demonstrate to the investing community what you're capable of.
Well, and they know that.
It's true on crowdfunding.
Well, people who invest in company startups a lot are looking for a certain type of person, and they know, they thought the project was going to be good too. So you go and the good investors get that, and they're looking for a type of person, and somebody who has that persistence and that grit and that work ethic and that creativity spark, all in one person, is a pretty hard combination to find. And so if you find that
person,
you
know what?
Well, I agree.
Sometimes you think you found it when you haven't. One of our very first campaigns was a guy, I'm not going to get into too much detail, but was so committed. He had some good connections. He was hounding us hour after hour, day after day for help. You know, let's get this thing going. We thought, okay, we've got a guy committed enough. We like the product. We're going to do it. We get about 2 weeks into it, and we find out that he's taking off for 2 weeks to go to a high school reunion and then on vacation.
Well,
and when, you know, you talk about success and failures, even we are blindsided sometimes by the fact that you think you know somebody and you think you know their work ethic, but until you've been through the ringer on something like this, you have no idea.
But I think what you're saying is the failure is okay if, see, you only worked with them for a little bit and then they go on vacation. And so like, God, they're a good salesperson. They really seemed like they had all the attributes, but they didn't.
Yeah.
But if you work with somebody on a long term with a project that ends up failing, but they have all those attributes and it just failed because it did. They taught you that they have those attributes. They showed you that they have those attributes.
Well, and they've taught the crowd too.
Yeah.
They really, I mean, you know, people underestimate the general public quite often. But my argument has always been that the crowd mind is just as smart, if not smarter, than any one individual. So, you know, you could look at this and contrast it and compare it to angel investors and VCs trying to make good decisions. And, you know, legitimately, VCs do it by, you know, grabbing an entire group of things, not just one. But angels have to be more specific. They really struggle to try and, you know, pick off individual good opportunities. And I'll make the argument all day long that the crowd is sitting there pointing out creatives and, you know, company owners in crowdfunding. They're sitting there shining a magnifying glass to the people's execution and their ideas. They're shining a magnifying glass on what is actually, you know, some of the best possible investment opportunities.
Well,
I think
they
the crowd's very smart, right? And I think we all underestimate that.
Well,
yeah.
We only have about another 7 minutes here. So I want to talk about the equity crowdfunding. And I know that's in the Obama's, talk about that, because I think that could change the landscape of investing.
Well, it will, and I'm going to have to speak really quick if you only have 7 minutes.
Well, we can have you back.
Have 50 minutes.
We could, okay. You know what we could
right,
do?
You...
We could do a whole nother show on equity financing. Maybe, you know, give it in about another 12 weeks or so. We could come back and talk about equity crowdfunding if you're interested and finish out with the rest.
I would love to. I'll give you the quick rundown if you'll give me a couple of minutes, because that's a great question, but it's certainly worthy of another show, because it's what more and more people are actually
interested in.
The majority of our calls used to be probably 80%, 90% about crowdfunding projects traditionally. Now that's flipped, and most of the calls that we're getting are about equity crowdfunding. But let me run through it real quick. And, you know, you may have read years ago there was an experiment where an accountant created documents for what should have been a relatively simple tax return, and he turned around and gave those to 20 different accountants. I don't know if you ever heard about that one, but of the 20 accountants, about 17 of them showed returns that differed in the outcome for the taxpayer. Right now, that's the same place that equity crowdfunding and the Jobs Act stand. You know, the SEC continues to work on it, but right now, you know, the only thing we know for sure is that, first of all, is that a company can raise $1 million a year from the crowd without having to go through an expensive process of registering the securities with the SEC. Okay, the company can't sell the stock or debt on its own. Instead, they have to go through a registered and licensed portal in the same way that you have a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo. And probably the greatest thing so far to come out of equity crowdfunding is that you have an exemption now called Rule 506C of Regulation D. And what that means is that you're able to now go out and you're able to advertise or to do away with the non-solicitation rule, and you can advertise to people in any way that you want to. Now, that may sound like it's not that big of a deal, but prior to that, if you were an entrepreneur and you wanted to raise any money, you had to have what they were termed as a substantial or pre-existing relationship with the prospective investor in order to receive any money. That meant that, you know, broadcasting your offer was out off the table. There were no ads, no email, no talk of fundraising.
Yeah, that's why I think
interviews.
That's why I think bottom line, it's just going to change the whole landscape of how investments are done. And I also read that a typical investor, a normal person, if they make $100,000, they can invest 10% of their money in this avenue. I mean, anybody can invest. Is that accurate?
I'll, Let me break it down for you real quick, since you're short on time, and we can get into this
this is a big subject that I think my listeners would really be interested in.
Okay, a company can raise $1 million a year. Okay, and every 5 years they'll adjust that for inflation. You know, so what?
But sure. Anyway, yeah.
And they can right now. What's very limiting to them is that they can only raise it from people who are considered accredited investors. Now, accredited investors, according to the SEC, are people whose individual net worth is $1 million, excluding their primary residence, or they have an individual income in excess of $200,000 in two of the most recent years, or if they have a spouse, in excess of $300,000 for those years, to make it a little harder. So,
sure,
in essence, to answer your question, though, where you said the amount that they can actually put into it, there's a yearly aggregate limit on the amount that each person can invest, and it's tiered by that person's net worth or yearly income. The limits are $2,000 or 5%, whichever is greater, for people earning or worth up to $100,000, and $100,000 or 10%, whichever is less, for people earning or worth $100,000 or more. So, you know, to quickly sum it up, when you talk about equity crowdfunding with someone, the company can raise $1 million a year. They have to go through a registered funding portal, and there are plenty of them out there, like Crowdfunder, Founders Fund, Circle Up, Angel List, and, you know, that means that to advertise their campaign, they can go out and they can advertise it to anyone, including sticking a sign in the front yard if they want to. The big holdup, and this is where it's so important where this falls, is that the money can only come from accredited investors. And as you mentioned just now, investors are restricted by the amount of money that they can actually invest. And now I think, you know, you can start to understand the frustration of those of us who want to move these rules along.
Oh, yeah. It's just a big quagmire. Okay, so now that to finish up and to wrap this thing up, what advice do you have for anyone considering crowdfunding? What would you say is the most important things?
JM, you want to start that one off?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the most successful people in crowdfunding, no matter whether it's equity or otherwise, are going to be those people who are trying to cultivate traction before they even start selling a thing. And, you know, obviously when you look in the investing space, there's lots of talk about traction in terms of, especially Silicon Valley investors, they're not going to invest in something where the thing is the greatest idea in the world, but has nobody backing it. So that's for me, that's my number one. That's what I harp on. That's what I tell everyone. That's where 98% of my conversations start and finish with all the people who reach out to us or reach out to me individually. It's all about cultivating relationships. And even if they're not tight relationships, still cultivating relationships.
Get those relationships built.
And mine's slightly different. I would say that the two things that I would offer people are, number one, to know that it is not easy. Crowdfunding is very, very hard work, and you're very likely not able to get it done on your own. You need to seek professional help in doing it. Now, that being said, that's my second piece of advice. John Michael and I, on a daily basis, have to listen to at least one, if not two people, who have been ripped off by all of these companies that are popping up out there left and right, that are saying, oh yeah, you want 50,000? We, looking at your project, we should be able to raise 250,000. Just pay us $7,000 up front, 5% on the back end, and we'll handle everything for you. And then they do nothing.
Yeah.
They put out a press release.
Well, you have to be careful, right?
References. You need to get references from the people that you deal with before you hand over your money. And anybody that tells you that crowdfunding is easy or that your campaign's going to be a walk in the park, you need to hang up the phone.
So there's scammers in that market too? And that wasn't funny. It's like in every market, you got to watch out for those people.
That's right. Anytime a new industry comes around where so much money is being tossed around, you can expect this to happen.
Yeah, it is what it is. Yeah, Be smart. True. Don't get yourself involved. And anytime anybody says something's too easy, you just have to walk away. Bottom line.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
I agree,
you guys are smart guys. I really appreciate you being on the show. I have to have you back to talk about the equity part of this, because I know this is going to change the whole – that's a business game changer. And so I need you
actually,
back. Go ahead.
It is. It is a game changer. It's going to, in fact, I believe it's probably going to be one of the largest game changers in finance that we've seen since 1933 with the SEC rules. I mean, it's going to change the landscape of how entrepreneurs fund and finance their businesses.
It's exciting.
It is
it's such a
large topic that we should do this again and do it for the entire hour.
Yeah, I agree with that, because there's so many. I don't know if you know, but I teach a class in the entrepreneurial school at the University of Minnesota, the Carlson School, and
right.
You know, that's what entrepreneurs need. They need a basis for this, because it's just so hard, and there's so it's cool to get the whole crowd. It's cool to get the whole public involved in this.
Not to go off subject, but I have to throw in a plug here. It sounds like your students are going to be the perfect type of people for John Michael's entrepreneurial board game.
Oh, they would be.
It's true. I didn't tell you what my product was. The actual product that we're working on is a board game to take people through Shark Tank meets the Game of Life type experience, and hopefully leave them better prepared than when they started for all of the experiences that they're going to have. So it's funny, but that's actually what we're working on.
It'd be one of those good high school games too, where the kids learn how to do a business and they play this game. And I don't, my son goes to a college preparatory school, and it seems like something very good for a school like that. You know, seniors, a little more advanced kids, and have them do something like that. But anyways, thank you.
Yeah, we definitely hope that we can, contribute in a positive way to all entrepreneurs' experiences, because we feel like that field of dreams mentality that shows up so often in entrepreneurship, it's not that I want to, reduce that in any way. I want that passion. I want to see that continue to thrive. But I also want to give people the opportunity to have
success.
More experience going in and
yes.
more likelihood of success as a result.
Absolutely. Well, you guys sound like you have some really good stuff going. Yeah, let's talk. I want to talk about doing this equity show. We'll talk offline of what date works best. And meanwhile, get me your contact information, because I want to get it up on the show's site, because I think a lot of people could be helped by you. But remember, people, listeners, I got to tell our listeners, remember what they said as advice before you call them, because it's really hard getting 50 calls a day, and they need to be able to have calls of people that they really think they can help. But anyways, what were you going to say in closing?
I was going to say, thank you for saying that. You may have cut our workload in half, number one. The other thing was, I'm glad that you chose this topic, because it is very important. It started to grow, and people are really under a lot of misconceptions. And when it comes to equity crowdfunding, it is right now in it's just blowing up. Our calls, as I said, have changed. Now they're mostly equity driven. And it's time for someone to get out there and talk about what's really going on and try to put it in simple terms. And we've done this enough and spent so many hundreds or thousands of hours on the phone with people talking this through that, we're more than happy to come back and do it.
Well, that's the future, I think. It's really quite neat. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was a great interview to talk about crowdfunding. It is a very hyped topic, and it isn't going to be successful unless you understand that there's more to it than just putting your name out there and your project out there. Nothing is that easy. Well, maybe the first projects were easier. I don't know, but they aren't anymore. You have to have a base of people to tie into. So these guys are great. If you have questions for them, you should contact them. But they will be back to talk about equity fundraising, and that I'm really excited about, because with this new Jobs Act that Obama put through, that could fundamentally change the way equity financing occurs in general. Could be the biggest change to finance
like they said, since 1932. I'm very excited about that. And we will have them back in a few weeks to talk about that. So I'm done talking today, and I want you to all have a wonderful day.